Before we start with today's episode, I want to address a common challenge that I've noticed among HVACR professionals. They often struggle to keep up with the advancements in heat pump technologies. That's why here at the ESCO Group, along with the HVACR Learning Network, we have an amazing library of courses to equip you with the essential skills for handling today's inverter-driven heat pumps. And better yet, we're offering free access to the first two chapters of our most popular course on the fundamentals of high-performance heat pumps. Check out the link in the show notes to get your free access.
The fines from the EPA being about $57,000 per violation per day. And let's face it, if you have an unrepaired refrigerant leak, you rarely have it for just one day, right? You realize it like 6 months after it happened is when you realize somebody forgot about it and didn't repair it, or you installed an appliance with an illegal refrigerant. They can go back 3 years, or you're not keeping records the way you have to. It doesn't take long to accumulate tens of millions of dollars in fines.
This episode is brought to you by Refrigerant Management Solutions and the North American Sustainable Refrigeration Council, NESRC, two organizations dedicated to shaping the future of refrigerant management and sustainability. Refrigerant Management Solutions provides expert consulting services to help end users navigate compliance and optimize refrigerant use, while NESRC is leading the charge in overcoming barriers to the adoption of natural refrigerants across North America. With increasing regulations and a push toward lower GWP refrigerants, these organizations are at the forefront of industry change, providing essential guidance and advocacy.
Do you have the knowledge to work with the next generation of refrigerants? ESCO Institute can help you learn the information you need with the Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Course. Did you know newer refrigerants are less harmful to the environment? Did you know there are new standards for the transportation of low GWP refrigerants? Did you know most A2L equipment will require refrigerant detection systems and you will be required to use no spark, no arc tools and equipment? Get the facts! These are just some of the things you need to know to work on new equipment. Take the online course to learn more. The ESCO Institute Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Course is interactive and engaging and will prepare you for the Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Certification Exam. You will find the Low GWP A2L Refrigerant Safety Course on the HVACR Learning Network, the industry's leading source of online and digital content. Visit hvacr.elearn.network today.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us again on Did You Know? The ESCO HVAC Show. We're so grateful that you took time out of your day to learn more about the industry, to become more aware of the changes that we are experiencing, both in refrigerant transitions as well as in technological transitions. So we're grateful to spend time with you. We want you to let us know in the chat where you're joining in from. If you have any questions along the way, please let us know. If you have additional topics that you think that you'd like to have covered on the show, we want that as well. We're trying to develop out this year for topics that mean the most to you. So we need your input. So today we have two fantastic guests with you. With us, we have our very own Jason Abjud. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. Thanks for having me.
And Keely Whitman, we are so grateful to have you today. We did a podcast a few weeks ago, and for those of you that haven't seen the podcast, if you go over to our YouTube channel, you're going to find, I would say it's probably our most controversial video that we've done yet, but I was just looking a while ago, and that thing was at like, I don't remember, 68,000 views or something. It was pretty crazy, but it was about regulations and change and things that are happening in our industry. Hey, Mr. Silberstein here to say hi. We got Patrick Murphy joining us from New Jersey. We've got Kendrick joining again. Thank you for hanging out with us. Kendrick has been hopping in here a lot, so I'm glad you're with us. A lot of these things are topics that we don't hear as much about in the industry, and so as a professional, we're grateful for all of our educators. Katie, thanks for being here again with us. Paul Leonardi, Tom Leck, a lot of people wanting to know about this changing industry that we have. So we're going to spend some time breaking down a topic that we've all heard about, but do we actually understand what it means, right? When we talk about refrigerant transitions, we know that we primarily judge or compare refrigerants based on two different things, right? Ozone depleting potential, global warming potential. Well, what are those? And then when we start talking about GWP, there's a couple other terms that most of the industry is not familiar with. GWP 20, GWP 100. Jason just did an article on that this last week and got blown up with controversy from the industry going, what is this? Hey, Jesse Stewart joining us from NAVAC. Thank you, sir. I got to get back with you too. Jesse sent me a text message the other day. We've been back and forth. I mean, it's how busy we all are in the industry. And Jason, I'm so grateful that you're taking time. Keely, I'm so grateful that you're taking time today because it really comes down to getting firsthand information in this industry. So Keely, will you tell us a little bit about your background in the industry? Because as I started to learn more about you, I went, whoa, how have we not met in the industry? Because this lady has done so many things for our industry. And this is the kind of people we love having on our show.
Sure. My pleasure. Thanks, first of all, for having me. I got my start in this industry. So I was a non-traditional student. I went back to graduate school very late in life and wound up doing an internship at the EPA and then slotted right into a job at the EPA in the Stratospheric Protection Division. Didn't know anything about refrigeration except, you know, hey, that's where you get the cold groceries. And had to learn it all from scratch, right? I do not have a technical background. I have a legal background. The EPA put me to, so the Stratospheric Protection Division is the branch of the EPA that regulates refrigerants. Started out regulating them because of how they harm the ozone layer. Yes. By the time I got there, though, they had shifted a lot of their focus to global warming potential. Historically, the relationship between the EPA and the people who use refrigerants, the end users, just consisted of, you know, being enemies, right? The EPA was just known as, oh, they're the bad guys. They enforce against everybody. They put me to work on a completely new idea, which was a voluntary partnership with the supermarket industry to cooperate with supermarkets to try to help everybody do a better job managing refrigerants, reduce the amount of refrigerant, transition to better refrigerants, reduce emissions. That was called the Green Chill Partnership.
Which is cool. Right.
That's right. That's right. So I did that for many, many years, then went out on my own, had my own business for a while. While I was doing that, I founded a nonprofit organization in this area called the North American Sustainable Refrigeration Council. That's an organization that is trying to work together as an industry to overcome some of the hurdles that prevent more broad adoption of natural refrigerants. Now I'm at a company called Refrigerant Management Solutions. We're consultants for refrigerant end users for everything related to refrigerant management, including a lot of compliance work. So that's me.
That's a lot. And both Green Chill and NASRC are still very important aspects of our industry. We've actually been working with NASRC on a CO2 curriculum for the industry.
Okay.
It's a very, very integral part of what we do. And that's why I was hoping to have both of you here today. This is really fun for me having, because I think I could just sit back and just let you two go and I can just sit back here and learn myself. It would be a good time. So what we want to do is, let me change perspectives on this. Let me get a different viewpoint. What we're going to do today, we're actually going to talk about global warming, and we're going to talk about measuring and metrics for global warming to hopefully give you a deeper understanding of the principles and concepts. If you remember, when we were talking about ozone depleting potential, which was the primary concern, the primary educational aspect from the 1990s and into the early 2000s. You know, I'm a product of Gen X, so all I heard about was the hole in the ozone as I was going through school, which we know now is, you know, contributed to synthetic chlorines that was introduced into the atmosphere. We had so whole conversation just on that one topic. And as Keely had mentioned, we shifted as we started getting into the new millennium, we started shifting focus more on the global warming perspective. Now, it was never completely isolated. We've always been tracking both of them, but the primary target was our ODP. That was the chlorine that we were utilizing in our generation of refrigerants, particularly known as CFCs and HCFCs. Now, when we transitioned and focused on global warming potential, it brought up some different aspects of the gases that we have in our atmosphere, and particularly ones that we are introducing back into our atmosphere, many of which have been trapped for millennia and are starting to be released. Some have been synthetically manufactured and also being released. Hey, a lot of people joining in today. Bruce, glad to have you here with us. Michael Harrison, Tom, thank you all for spending some time with us today.
Clifton, I will bring up that it was Section 608 of the Clean Air Act that addressed ozone depletion potential in particular, and that was like the focus of it. And it set phase out and phase down schedules for CFCs and HCFCs, which led us to HFC, again, which have no ODP, but again, do have this issue that you have here on screen, GWP, global warming potential.
Yeah, as when we start getting into that HFC phase down, I'm going to rely on you a lot for helping explain some of that. You do a fantastic job of helping people see where that is, because it's not like something we're starting, like we're halfway through it already. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah, a lot of folks will ask, okay, when is this going to happen? It's already been happening. We're, already through the first leg of it.
Exactly.
Well, and Clifton, it's interesting because I find that when you start explaining about ODP and GWP, for a lot of people out there, you know, they're out there repairing equipment or purchasing equipment, and they don't spend their whole lives thinking about the environmental consequences, right? They've got enough to do their own job. I find that sometimes you're even starting a couple steps beyond where sometimes I find it helpful to start, right? Mm-hmm. Why? What is the reason for having ODP and GWP? It's a way that you can express how bad something is in relation to other things.
Yeah.
And you know what? I find the best example, it finally clicks to people when I compare it to the Scoville Index for hot peppers, right?
Oh, sure.
Right? Because you say, somebody says there's a new, triple X ghost pepper in India. Yeah. And they're kind of like, it's really hot. Well, of course, everybody's definition of really hot is different. You need some kind of a way to compare different things on the same scale. And whether it's wasabi or black pepper or, peppers from Mexico or Thailand or whatever, they're all very different things, but you need to be able to measure how red does it make your face turn, right? And it's the same with global warming potential, right? So they just took carbon dioxide as the baseline, and 404A has a global warming potential that tells you that it is almost 4,000 times worse for the environment than carbon dioxide is. And a lot of people, they talk about GWP, ODP, but if you start talking about really what that even means or why we're even talking about it, a lot of times people have just skipped beyond that question. Exactly. And you realize the concepts are more difficult to understand because no one has ever explained the foundation of it all.
No, that you're exactly right. That's why we wanted to have this conversation. Primarily, we're going to have educators here. I see many of our attendees already as educators, and they're constantly looking for ways that they can bring this information to their students and help it make more sense. And so I personally like to use the explanation that we look at ODP for how much heat are we going to allow in, and we look at GWP as how much heat are we going to hold in once it gets here. And so if we look at that and then go, okay, but yeah, we need a metric for that now. And that's where you're right. That whole CO2 comes into play as being a foundational number, a place that we can start, because we're not saying that CO2 is good when we release CO2
that's right.
Here. We're just saying that it is a known number. And so we can use our calculations to base that. And so
I'd like to also point out that, again, CO2 has long been a part of the atmosphere for longer than we've been around. They've been able to measure CO2 consistently in the atmosphere stratosphere for quite a long time. So it is a known number, a given baseline. So it's a good guess to use as a foundational comparison because it's for as far as we know, always been there and will always be there.
Exactly. Well, I spent some time today throwing this together because one of the top questions you'll get from students, one of the most difficult comments to address on social media is when people say, yeah, but a refrigerant is heavier than air, so it should never be in the atmosphere. So I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about that and show you somewhat of analytics. I'm data-driven. I have to have numbers on conversations that I have. And so I want us to think about this for a little bit. If we look at air, right, we're actually going to use the molar mass scale. So we're going to be comparing weights because a lot of people say, you know, refrigerant is heavier than air. What are you saying when you mention that? You're talking about the weight of something in comparison to other things. If we look at weights, right, we could look at air and say, all right, we're around 28 or so grams per mole when we start talking about weight. But when you look at that and you think about things like, say, water, right, run over to water at around 18 grams per mole. And we say, well, water technically is lighter than air. But how do we have clouds? Eugene Silberstein, who's on the show today, actually helped explain this to me one time on a bus down in Atlanta, coming back from a show, and where we're talking about densities and weights. He said, but if how can water be on the ground and be in the air at the same time? It's a very, very clear visual to see moisture in the air and understand, all right, we've got moisture in there. But if you run all the way across real quick and see where sand is at, right? Silicon dioxide. Now we're talking about 60 grams per mole. We're talking about a fairly heavy substance. But has anyone ever heard of Sahara dust? I figured I wouldn't be able to stump either one of you, but I was going to throw it out there anyhow, right? So we have trade winds that will bring dust from Africa, travel all the way across the Atlantic and deposit in different places, including the United States, right? It's a very integral part of our trade winds and bringing nutrients into soils. Right here in the Midwest, we actually get sands that come from Africa. Well, wait a minute. If I've got something that's twice the weight of air, how is it actually in the air? Well, it really starts coming down to understanding that weight is only in proportion to size, right? If we look at a variety of different substances, we can take its weight and go, what about steel? Steel's so heavy, it should never be in the air. But if I have enough force, and if I have enough wind, if I have enough push and movement, I can put steel up in the air. And I can suspend it if I have momentum. So when we look at refrigerants, yes, they are a heavier substance than air, most refrigerants. But when we start looking at how they actually can sustain in the atmosphere, it really comes down to a displacement, right? Being able to move something based on its size, its molecular size. So a very simple analogy you can use in a classroom. If someone says, but refrigerants are heavier than air and they shouldn't be up in the sky to begin with. And you can go, well, what about water? You've got water on the ground and you've got water in the air. How's it heavier and lighter at the same time? It's really a matter of how much is in a certain amount of space, right? Comes down to what size is that actual molecule of these chemicals. So refrigerants can, in concentrated, absolutely be heavier than the air around it. But once diluted into the atmosphere around it, the air around it, now it just gets introduced into that gas. Because if you look at things like argon and CO2, both of those are heavier than air, but they're actually a part of air, right? It all comes back into that dilution of those chemicals. So when we have those controversies in the classroom of, is refrigerant heavier than air? Yes. Can it still be in the atmosphere? Absolutely, it can.
There's also some chemical reactions that may take place when we introduce UV. If you get it outside, we can have some molecular breakdown where certain molecules will make it up from a specific, say, 410A or 32 or any of the refrigerants listed here. If we have any ultraviolet radiation that reacts with it, we can actually start to break apart some of those chemicals into molecules, which will then, again, rise up into the atmosphere, as you said.
Molecules.
Right.
Gotcha. Right. So just a little extra knowledge to be able to utilize in a classroom or in the conversation when we get on those topics. So as we start talking about this refrigerant transition, I hope we all understand that we really are trying to do the right things for our planet. Right. And so we are going to be transitioning a bunch of refrigerants out of the industry that are very common. We get comments all the time on social media. Well, why don't you bring back R12? It worked great. Why don't you bring back R22? It worked great. You're taking away the good stuff. Well, depends on how you look at it. It's all in perspective. What is good and what is bad? Is it good for a refrigeration system but bad for the atmosphere? Exactly like Keely had mentioned a while ago. Sometimes we become very myopic in what we are looking at, what we're understanding, because as a technician, yes, a refrigerant might seem good because it functions well and I don't have to work on a piece of equipment very often, not understanding how destructive it can be to an atmosphere.
The other thing is... Go ahead, Keely.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, acid is always is also a great cleaning agent, but do you wash your face with it? Right? I mean, you're talking about two different things, right? You're talking about its performance in terms of its cooling ability, right? That is one factor. And I have heard over and over again, R12 was the best, and then R22 was the best. It seems like everything else that comes up is just never the best, right? It's always the worst. Well, all right, that's one factor of the 25 different factors you can look at to determine what you should be using, right? And unfortunately, with something that harms the environment to the point where the ozone layer, right? Deplete the ozone layer, guess what? You get skin cancer, you get cataracts, you get all kinds of effects. So you know what? Performance isn't all that matters, right? Other things matter too. Ronald Reagan himself said, all of his cabinet members said, you shouldn't sign this Montreal Protocol thing. He said, you know what? I want my grandchildren to be able to play outside.
Exactly.
If we don't do this, at some point in time, if you go outside for longer than 5 minutes, you're going to get a terrible sunburn. And I don't want my grandkids to do that, right? So yeah, it is perfectly fine to say R12 is fantastic, but you have to qualify that by saying in terms of performance, right? One factor.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
The other thing that people are, you know, miss when you say it was a good refrigerant is that you could use it in a variety of places and a variety of applications. And we're starting to see that less and less as we move forward, where we have a very specific application. There's a GWP limit there. And so we have one refrigerant for commercial refrigeration, one for comfort cooling, smaller systems, one for larger comfort. So we're ending up with more and more refrigerants very specific to applications. Whereas back in the day, we had like three refrigerants and they did everything. All right, so moving forward, that's another, again, downfall is that, oh, bring back you could use R12 everywhere. But today we're, again, getting very specific in temperature applications and specific subsectors of the industries. We place limits on those subsectors based, again, on their GWP.
And that's really what this conversation is about, is that GWP, and then we're going to break down the GWP-20 and the GWP-100, so you have a little bit more clarification, because GWP and global warming is going to be a part of your everyday conversation as an HVACR professional going forward.
Yeah, I put the apology out there about that. We put that out there, and I got blown up with, what is this, and what is that? Is this? It's not new. It's been around for a minute. It needs an explanation.
Exactly. And that's what this conversation is going to be about, is to help you see that. You know, there was a time, even myself, as I'm going to start pulling out the redneck references for this one, okay? So there was a point of a time in my life where I was very neutral on the whole global warming stance. I in life in general, politics, I stay fairly neutral. I like to listen and to observe and try to formulate my own understanding from a variety of different inputs. I don't like just having individual inputs. And I can tell you, as a redneck technician, I spend a lot of time here in the Midwest mushroom hunting, morel mushroom hunting. I absolutely love it. In the springtime, when the morels are up for about 3 weeks, don't call me. You're not going to get a hold of me because I'm going to be in the woods. I've done this my entire life. And the thing with morel mushrooms is they really grow in a very specific area. They need a specific ground temperature. They need a specific humidity. They grow as a colony. You know, really, we're at the mushroom, we're really seeing the flower of a growing colony underneath of them. And they're fairly valuable. So generations would keep their mushroom holes, their honey holes, as a secret, right? If you find a good mushroom hole, your grandkids are going to be finding good mushrooms at that same hole. And so it was a very traditional item that we passed down for generations. And I had mine that was given to me at that time by my son's grandfather. And I knew every year I was going to pull 10, 15, maybe even 20 pounds of mushrooms out of this hole every year. And around 2008-ish, somewhere in that ballpark, I went mushroom hunting one spring. And I noticed that because this is in a valley, right? So they're catching sunlight, particularly on that west side of a hillside. And I'm going to tell you all my secrets. But anyhow, so the mushroom patch is always in the same place, right? And in one year, I noticed it moved up the hill about a foot or so. The entire patch moved up the hillside about a foot. The following year, it moved about another foot. And over about a 7-year period, it finally moved up to the hill to the point that the patch disappeared. And we've never found any mushrooms in this spot ever again. So it was something that was real to me. It was something that I noticed had changed. And whatever was happening was real. And that's when we really started focusing on global warming potential. And so as an instructor, I want to empower you with resources to be able to have these conversations in the classroom. One thing that I would like for you to, when you get some time, I would like you to go over to, let me actually pull it up for you real quick so you have this as a reference. I would like for you to go over to climate.gov. And I would like for you to skim through the resources if you're looking for training material, content curriculum, anything that you would like to add in that has a lot of validated scientific information. Great short videos to play. I'm going to, real quick, I'm going to hop over and show you a very short one on our ice cap as an evolution, just as data. And then you can use that for your own conclusions. So as you can see, in that same time period that we witnessed that significant shift in the polar ice caps, which was caused from increased temperatures, I also witnessed the same thing in my mushroom patch, my honey hole, right? So we encourage you to use sites like this for data that you can use in the classroom. Whatever stance you have, you are responsible to have data for when we have these discussions as a professional. And so we just want to empower you with data. All right, so what does all this mean? Keely, this ought to look familiar. I borrowed this from one of your PowerPoint presentations. Tell us a little bit about how some of the initiatives have changed, particularly from the EPA, to start focusing more on things like global warming potential of refrigerants.
Yeah, so it's funny. I tend to focus my conversations on the practical, right? And people normally appreciate that because as a consultant, I charge by the hour. So I don't often get people who are willing to pay me to sit and talk about whether climate change is real. Even when I was at the EPA, I remember one of the first presentations I gave, somebody said, this was back in 2008, somebody first question raised their hand and said, is climate change real? And this was a supermarket conference. And I just responded and I said, you know what? I don't really care. I said, do your supermarket customers care? Do they make decisions on where to shop, which supermarket company to shop with based on your environmental ethics?
Yeah.
Not everybody, but certainly about 50% of the population does. So whether you believe it or not, who cares, right? If your customers care, you're supposed to be selling groceries. That's your job. Talk about this kind of thing when you go out with your friends for a beer, right? That's fine. So the other practical side of it, which is why I brought it up, is guess what? Whether you believe in it or not, if you don't want to spend millions of dollars in fines, you have to comply with the regulations, okay? So, you know, and basically different administrations have different priorities, of course. Every couple of years, the EPA sits down and they do a big effort to determine what are they going to focus their enforcement actions on over the next couple of years. And for the first time ever, the last time they did that, right, they came out with this in August, I think, of 2023. They issued their document. They had determined that one of their top three enforcement priorities for the next period of time up to and including 2027 was going to be HFC regulations related to climate change. Now, all the enforcement activities that have happened up until now, right? All the supermarket companies, the millions and millions and millions of dollars, that all happened before the EPA considered it a priority, right? So what is it going to be like now that the EPA says, hey, it's a priority, right? And I myself know of several enforcement actions that are ongoing right now. Yes. And the EPA has a lot of activity out there. You don't find out about it. It doesn't become public information until they finish the enforcement action and they come to an agreement with the violator, the subject of the enforcement action. And then they'll issue a press release. And by that point in time, the case has been going on probably for 3, 4, sometimes even 5 years, right? So it won't be long now before they will all come to fruition and there's going to be a wave of announcements by the EPA. And with the fines from the EPA being about $57,000 per violation per day, and let's face it, if you have an unrepaired refrigerant leak, you rarely have it for just one day, right? You realize it like 6 months after it happened is when you realize somebody forgot about it and didn't repair it, or you installed an appliance with an illegal refrigerant. They can go back 3 years, or you're not keeping records the way you have to. It doesn't take long to accumulate tens of millions of dollars in fines.
Indeed. And so it really, it shows and it validates that we are getting a little bit more strict on management, right? We're going to be seeing a lot of changes. No matter what happens with presidency, we're going to have changes in our industry that are already set and in play, right? And it all comes back. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, Clifton, just one thing to add on to it, though. I've always considered myself fortunate to be in this environmental area, because it just so happens that refrigerant leaks also cost money. Yes. As honestly, doing the right thing environmentally very, very often turns out to be the right thing financially. The Green Shield Partnership had something that I think it was officially called the financial impact calculator, but everybody called it the milk calculator. And people would chase me down the hallway saying, hey, you're the milk calculator lady. And like, yeah. And you know, what happened was supermarkets have like a 1% profit margin, right? And so you know how much refrigerants cost per pound. At the time, this was in like 2008, 2009. And frankly, you know, R22 at the time was maybe like $12 a pound or something like that. Yeah. At the time, we calculated just the refrigerant replacement cost for a 100-pound leak. You had to sell like 30,000 gallons of milk to just buy 100 pounds of refrigerant, right? At a 1% profit margin.
Sure.
So, you know, there are other areas, environmental areas, where it just costs everybody money. Frankly, the best thing we have going for us in the supermarket industry is that doing a good job has a huge impact on your bottom line as a supermarket company.
No, I completely get that. So either way you look at it, whether you look at it from a warming perspective, you look at it from a financial perspective, we are doing this. And in doing that, we're starting to have a little, I wouldn't call it a variation in calculations. We just want to make sure that we have a clarification of calculations. So I'm going to come back to these here in a minute, Jason, because I think it's a really good time for us to talk about where these calculations come from. They're going to be used for the refrigerants that we are currently working with in our next generations of refrigerants to understand how they can have different global warming potentials. And so this really is a part of the conversation that got supercharged and energized in this last week. And it even took myself a minute to step back and dive into it to go, okay, I'd never really thought about that. I always used it as a number, but I hadn't used it as like a calculation. So if you don't mind, I'm sure both of you can speak on this, and who knows,
really quick
during the rest of the show on this one slide.
I just wanted to point out that whether you believe, like she had Healy had mentioned about, you know, doing the right thing saves money. Whether you believe in global warming or you don't, or whatever your beliefs are, I will tell you this, that letting refrigerant out is also poison. You can't breathe it.
No.
You know what I mean? So whether you, whatever your beliefs are, by letting refrigerant in the air, you're actually polluting. And eventually we're going to have enough of it out there where none of us can breathe. All right. So we want clean air to breathe on top of the other environmental factors. What we're going to discuss here, what we're seeing here is a global warming potential chart that lists these numbers. There are different reports. The IPCC comes out with reports every few years. There's eight. The most recent are AR 4, 5, and 6. There's 20-year, 100-year, and even 500-year scales. And what these are based on, one, how long does this refrigerant stay in the atmosphere to do whatever it's going to, you know, to have the effect that it's going to have.
Sure.
And then the other part of this is the ability of it to trap heat, we call radiative efficiency. The sun shines down on the earth and most of our surface is water and ice and things, and we reflect a lot of it back into space and we get rid of a lot of heat that way. But if we have these gases in our atmosphere, if they're lingering, they can actually absorb and trap, slow that process down. They don't stop it completely, but they can slow it down. So when the heat comes in, heat energy, and it gets reflected back out, these gases can kind of absorb that heat and slow it down, keep it right here. And we start to, like that itchy insulation wrapped around the earth, right? The roll of fiberglass insulation gets in your skin. It's like wrapping one of those around the planet when we get enough of these gases up there. The lifetime of these gases varies. Some are 10 year, 15, 20. I mean, every gas is different. It's life, how before it decays in our atmosphere. So when we look at the 20 year for a lot of these gases, they're exceptionally high. We're looking at the immediate effects. The next 20 years, what are the immediate effects of this gas?
Right.
If we look at it over 100 years, you'll see lower numbers. Because again, let's take, for example, a gas that has a atmospheric lifespan of, say, 15 years. All right. If we look at that 20 year, it's going to be pretty high. All right. The number. If we look at the 100 year, it's going to be significantly lower because for 15 years, it has this effect. And as it decays, now we have 85 years of zero. You know what I mean? So it's going to bring that number down, the whole average down. We have 15 years worth of data and then 85 years worth of zeros. So it brings the whole average down. And what we're doing is comparing both the lifespan and the efficiency to trap heat to CO2. So this is a ratio based on, again, CO2 having a value of 1. And then, for example, let's look at 410A. We're looking at the AR4. Just to be clear here, some people said when I put the chart out there in the article I wrote, I put the AR4 value of R32. It's 576. And this guy's like, well, no, it's like 750. That's in the AR6 report, not in the AR4. AR4 is what is codified in the federal regulation. So this is what we have to use. All right. We aren't using AR5 or AR6. AR4 is what's codified. So this is what we have to go by. All right. And then everyone says, well, why even bring up GWP20? Well, there are some states that have their own environmental laws that are using GWP20 instead of the GWP100. They want to know the immediate effects of these gases in the air. There are some that have very little. If you look at 290, it's 3 over the long term, 0.7 in the short. I mean, they're really low.
Right.
But if we look at 410A, we got 2088, roughly. I want to say 2088. And then if you look at it over the 20 year, it's 4715. Again, we're looking at that shorter. So what that means.
Window of time. Yeah.
If you want a tool, if you want to say, all right, how do I explain this to my students? You can, there's two ways you can do it. You can say that on a ratio scale, you can say 410A traps 2,088 times as much heat as CO2 in proportion. Or you can say leaking 1 pound of 410A to the atmosphere is the same as leaking 2,088 pounds of CO2. They are the environmental equivalent. So there's two ways you can look at that.
So if we started from scratch today, we should be using the 20-year GWP for HFCs, because if you take something that only exists for 15 years and you measure it across 100 years, where, like you said, 85 years of that is zero and 15 years of it is incredibly potent, what you're really doing is you're kind of cheating. Well, why not take it across 1,000 years? Right? Right. If I take it across enough years, I can get all of those numbers down to zero.
Right.
And here's what I do. I compare it to peeing in a pool, right? So someone is standing next to you in the pool. They pee in the pool, right?
Yep.
If you let enough time go by across the entire size of the swimming pool, you can't detect any of that pee, right? But guess what? I'm standing right next to the person who peed. I can smell it.
It's kind of warm in here.
That if you give me 5 months, you won't even be able to detect that. I'm standing in the pee, right? And that's what happens with HFCs. They are in the atmosphere now. They may only last for 15 years, but they're in there now, and they are having an incredibly large effect for the time they are in the atmosphere. The reason we started with GWP 100 is because all people worried about and were really aware of was carbon dioxide. And a 100-year measurement made sense for carbon dioxide, right? For us, really, you want to be looking at what is the warming effect while it is warming, not diluted and watered down by the whole time that it doesn't even exist, right?
Here we go.
So then the AR6 is just, I just explain that to people that, a bunch of scientists get together, they do their best with the knowledge that they have available, and they come out with a report that measures the global warming potentials. Guess what? The next year they have a little bit more information, a little bit better information, they come out with a new list. And then a couple of years later, they come out with a new list, right? So every time they come out with a report, the global warming potentials change based on new information. But you are absolutely correct. A lot of the regulations and a lot of what we do and a lot of the science and the reports and everything at the United Nations was based on this AR4 report. So a lot of people just say, you know what, we don't want to live in a world where I have to keep changing 675 to 672 or whatever. Let's just stick with what we started with. That's not really the point of whether it's 675 or 672, right? The point is it's bad and we need to do something about it. So that's why a lot of the regulations that come out, even though there are newer numbers in the AR5 and the AR6, for consistency reasons, to not have to constantly be passing new laws and everything else when the numbers change, they just stick with the AR4. Now, New York State, right, just passed their regulations. So that happens.
Started all of this.
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you what, I'm on the past couple of weeks, I've been dealing with this, and nothing has made me want to consider changing professions as much as this stuff that has just come out. But the point really is, New York State wants you to basically get down to, almost nothing, right? They want you to get down to zero. They want you to use certain things, whether they make you measure it on AR6 or AR4, they want you to go down to CO2. And possibly if we had the technology, propane, there may be some of these pure A2Ls coming out, but they want you to get as close to zero as you can. That's the point, not whether it's, the 20-year GWP or the 100-year GWP or the AR6 or the AR4. But there is a rationale for looking at the 20-year GWP for HFCs, and it's a very good rationale. It screws us all up. It's very, very annoying. But you can't argue with the rationale, although I'm sure after this, there will be plenty of people who do argue with the rationale.
I can tell you that in the face of what we have today and where we're at today, our actions over the next 20 years are more important than they are over the next 100 years.
That's right.
We need to know the immediate effect, because we may not have 20 years to adjust anything. That's one thing. Two, the reason we have to keep doing this and restricting this and doing this is because these refrigerants and these gases and chemicals are ending up in the atmosphere in the first place.
Yes.
One thing we can do on our end is to make sure that we're fixing leaks, to make sure that we're recovering refrigerant. And again, there's the monetary side of it. If we're fixing leaks, we're not having to charge over and over and over. That's one. Two, if we're recovering refrigerant, especially the HFCs, the reclaimers are paying pretty good money for recovered HFCs so that they can reclaim it and get it back on the market. That's and if correct. We do that, if we create that circular economy, then nothing goes up and we don't have to worry about GWP. All right. It's only when it gets out that these numbers are realized. When these, if it's in the system contained in the tank, if we're containing it, we don't have to worry about this. Once it gets out and gets up there, now it's a problem. Now these numbers are real. Yeah.
But that's correct. And you know what? It is interesting too. I know when I started out with the Green Chill partnership, I got a lot of flack because we focused on, you know, new technologies that used refrigerants with less environmental impact. And we focused on leaks, emissions, right? And we decided, though, too, to focus on charge size. So the amount of refrigerant that is in your equipment. And I got a lot of flack for that. And actually, one of my very, very good friends, he brings that up and he says, you know, the first year that I knew Keely, I did not like her because we had this ongoing argument. And he said, I was very much against this business that it made any sense to reduce the amount of refrigerant you're using in the first place, right? Well, a lot of the newer technologies, they focus on just reducing the amount of refrigerant that you have to use in the equipment to begin with. So for instance, it's much better if you've got a 10% leak rate. It's much better to leak 10% of 100 pounds than it is to leak 10% of 2,000 pounds, right? And no matter how good you are, especially in the supermarket setting, no matter how good you are with your refrigerant management, no matter what you do with detection and repair and everything else, you still have people that crawl up on your roof and steal your copper piping. You still have a 16-year-old kid that slams into something with a forklift. So you still have these catastrophic leak situations where it doesn't matter what you did, what you invested, there was no way to prevent that. And when that happens, it's much better to leak a lot less refrigerant with a catastrophic leak versus what we used to do. The attitude used to be, pump that receiver full, put another couple hundred pounds in there, put off. Who cares how much refrigerant you use, right? So that is another thing that has changed. Not so much, I think, in the residential air conditioning area, but certainly in the supermarket setting, we have moved gradually, slowly but surely, we've moved to a lot of these technologies that just use a lot less refrigerant.
No, absolutely. And we're going to be seeing a lot more of that in every sector of the industry.
That's
you,
right.
You can't leave this industry. We need you.
Look at these numbers. A lot of this also has to do moving forward with the legislation that's been passed.
Right.
Certain subsectors are limited to what the GWP of the refrigerant will be allowed in that subsector,
yes.
Specific to a surface, yeah, to a date. So like ice makers or chillers or supermarket rack systems, comfort cooling split systems, package systems, those sorts of things. Moving forward, all of these refrigerant transitions, if you will, are going to be based off of these numbers that we're looking at on screen, right? They're going to be based off of GWP. So,
correct.
Like you said, in the 90s, all we heard about was ODP. And there, you know, we have a picture of the hole. You can see the picture of the hole in the ozone. For everyone's, it's not real. Here's a picture of it. Look at it. You could Google it. It's Uncle Google has it on there. So, moving forward, we're again, in the 90s, it was ODP. Today, it's going to be GWP, and all of the stuff moving forward, again, will take its root from these charts, from the AR4 or 5. Right now, again, it's AR4. All of the legislation, all of the regs that are in the Federal Register reference AR4. It would be a tall order to try and redo all of that to AR6. So for the time being, we're going to use the AR4, but you're going to see these numbers continuously getting lower and lower and lower. As she said, they want to get everyone as close to zero as possible.
Sure. And that's why I wanted us to dive deep into this, because when Jason brought this up, when we were having this conversation, you know, I hadn't thought about the aspect of what if we changed from AR4 to AR6, right? AR6 to me means a lot more. I mean, it shows me exactly what the impact is in my lifetime.
It's the latest modeling, right? So they use models to, you know, push this out. This is the most advanced modeling thus far is the AR6.
Exactly. But if we were to change any legislation, technology transition rule, anything, we'd have to change all of it. So it's probably not going to happen.
Right.
So
that's a tall order.
From a federal perspective, we are probably going to continue seeing a lot of these AR4 numbers. And really, to hit home with this, this is really the slide that shows all of it. I've actually got a different one that shows all of, well, I wouldn't say all of them, but a larger list to show you the representation of this 20-year impact versus a 100-year impact. This is, well, it's right from Refrigerant Management Solutions. I mean, this is right. This is whole Keeley's data to be able to share and to show you what this topic is. So as an individual, the 20-year means a lot more to me. It's easier to show the impact of the refrigerants that we're using in a shorter period of time. But in reality, legislation is probably going to continue working on this AR4 because it's the current standard. So when you see these numbers, we just need for you to be able to recognize where they come from, because we may see more. If we continue seeing an escalation in global temperatures, if you didn't know, these last 2 years have been the highest global temperature readings ever recorded. If we continue to see an escalation of the warming of our planet, we're going to do everything we can to try to minimize that. So we might see an AR7, an AR10, 20. We don't know how far we'll go because we'll be continually reviewing and updating these models, right?
So it's not a bad thing if we stay on AR4, okay? We just see lower and lower numbers. You know what I mean? So for the time being, they said, okay, let's use comfort cooling, split systems, package systems. They said, you know, starting January 1 of this year, we can't make anything with 700 GWP or less. All right, that 700 means something, right? If we wanted to address this, we don't necessarily have to change the AR we're using. We could just lower that 700 to say 350. You know what I mean? So we can always lower those numbers down rather than having to try and go through and legislatively update like 60 or 80 pieces of legislation from AR4 to AR6. We can just lower those numbers, again, using the same AR. So it's not like we're behind. We can still do it.
Right.
It's just you get used to seeing these numbers and what they mean.
Yeah. And so hopefully we will minimize the social media arguments over global warming numbers, which is really what?
I will also tell you this. Yeah. If you're going to cite GWP, cite the AR report you're pulling it from. If you look
that's
at the case that I did put up there, I listed right under each of the GWPs which AR report it came from. So if I'm going to list a GWP in parentheses, I'll put AR4, AR5, AR6.
That's right.
And now you know what that means. You, the listeners, and exactly. Want to see what it means. AR4 is this report, the one we have codified in the Federal Register. There's an AR5, there's an AR6, there will be an AR7. So if you're going to cite a GWP somewhere, in parentheses, list your AR4, and there shouldn't be any confusion.
That's exactly right. It's transparency, right? In order for me to understand your numbers, I have to know, all right, well, where are you taking your numbers from, right? It's not, one is not right and the other one is not wrong. It's just in order for me to know what you're talking about and what the significance of it is, I need to know which numbers you're using, or even for me to know whether your numbers are correct or not, right? I need you to tell me, did you take it from the AR4 or the AR6? One isn't right and the other one isn't wrong. So, yeah.
You know, yeah. You brought up a good point. I was actually studying this a while ago, thinking about that. And I've got my own thought on R290 propane, of why the number is so low over 20 year versus it's 100. My personal aspect is that in that the lifespan of that refrigerant, are either one of you familiar or comfortable with that one at all? That would be my perspective that I would see why that would be lower, is the life expectancy of that R290.
So somebody brought that up to me and I did some reading about it. And honestly, then it hasn't come up since. And I don't even want to try to put what I learned together again and make any claims on it. But it is correct.
6.5 minutes. Come on now.
But it's correct, right? The more recent versions of the numbers it doesn't necessarily mean that they always all go up or they always all go down. It's just they have better information and it can work either way, right? Some of the GWP values, you get more information and you realize, oh, you know what? We may have overestimated that a little bit in the past, so let's correct that, right? And propane is one of those. Now, you know, whether it matters that, you know, one time it's 3 and the next time it's 2.6 and the next time it's, we talk about, you know, there have been these generations of refrigerants and we talk about the high GWP refrigerant generation in the supermarket industry was when we transitioned from R22. High GWP for us was 404A, 507. You were talking about close to 4,000. Then we went to kind of the better GWP, but it turned out it's kind of like mid GWP. We went to the 407 series, right? Then we went down and we had like the 448, 449 series. Again, a lot better. So high GWP, medium GWP, a little bit lower GWP. In order to actually accurately talk about low GWP, there's no like agreed upon
Where's the goalpost
number out there. Right. But in general, where everybody's coming down is that in order to be low GWP, it's got to be 150 or less, right?
On the AR4.
The difference here. If you look at this chart that we're seeing, the AR4 is 100-year and the 20-year is the AR6. So there's one of the differences between those two numbers. Mm-hmm. To when you get down 2.3, 2.1, as she pointed out, 2.6. When you get down to those numbers that are that small, there's a plus or minus on accuracy when you're using computer modeling, especially when you're using chemicals and refrigerant grade propane versus. So some of these numbers that you may see might be the gas that you have in your tank by the grill, which is completely different from a refrigerant grade propane. All right. So they would have a different GWP, the two different propanes, believe it or not. So when you're looking at that, again, when you get down into that small end of the scale, and because it's a ratio, you are going to see variances like that.
But still, regardless of which AR report you use, the consensus has slowly but surely turned out to be that low GWP has to be less than 150, right? And there's not enough of a difference that there are refrigerants out there that, you know, turn like the AR6 doesn't turn a low GWP refrigerant into a high GWP refrigerant, right? We're talking about such minuscule differences. But now what we're talking about is even a new category because 150 is not great, right? We're talking about ultra low GWP. And in order to be considered an ultra low GWP, we're kind of coming to the agreement unofficially that it has to be like less than 5. Some right. people say less than 10, right?
Yeah, GWP 20 of 10 is what I saw, right?
Well, yeah, but others don't use the GWP. Right. You know, I mean, like even in Europe, right? I mean, Europe, like if you're talking about low GWP, or some people have been saying ultra low GWP and they mean 150. And it's kind of like, no. There's a better category than that, right? We're talking ultra low GWP is, you know, very, very close to zero, right? When you're talking about that. And it's the new generation that we can do better than low GWP. I sound like I'm doing a $6 million man commercial. We have the technology. We can achieve this, right? We can go to ultra low GWP.
Yeah, we absolutely can. You know, when we start looking at where we are in this transition to ultra low GWPs.
That's right.
Accept it or not, we are. And as educators, we are responsible for being ahead of the curve so that we know what is coming. That way we'll be comfortable with it and not caught with our pants down like many people in the industry is right now. So when we look at this transition, We understand, I should have thrown in some technology transition role ones, but Jason and I have done some great classes on the technology transition role, where these GWP numbers come into play for newly manufactured equipment. The other side of that is all of our higher GWP refrigerants that fall into the HFC class, right? Those are all high GWP refrigerants. The entire class of HFCs are in the middle of their phase down. It's not 100% phase out. It's a phase down, but by 85% reduction by the year 2036. Think about that. Within 11 years, right? That's all. Within 11 years, our higher GWP refrigerants will be gone, which means we're already starting to focus on what are the replacement refrigerants. We're making that transition. Remember, especially in the residential sector, when we look at residential and light commercial split systems, and we call these new refrigerants, both of them are HFC refrigerants. Never, ever, ever forget that. Many of the refrigerants that we are working with right now that we are calling low GWP, kind of going back to your point, we might call them low GWP, but in honesty, they're in the middle of phase out right now.
Phase down right now.
And so we have hit that additional 40% reduction, right? Or that baseline 40% reduction from our baseline. So we are making some very quick changes. And that next one that's going to happen in there in 2029,
4 years.
So you can imagine within 4 years, we are going to be focusing very heavily on these ultra low GWP refrigerants. And that's really what we're doing, is trying to prepare you for that. So we're not scaring you here at ESCO. We always try to stay as far ahead in the industry as we can, try not to go out 20 years for education, but we need to know, we need to be able to plan for what is going to be incorporated into our classroom within these next 5 years. And here's where it is. And so we hope
one way to bridge this gap in this phase down is recovered and reclaimed refrigerant.
That's
as you start to see these supplies start to dry up or become scarce, the way we fill this gap or maintain legacy equipment that run on these refrigerants is through reclaimed refrigerant. And if we're not recovering and bringing it back, then there's not going to be anything there when we go to the well to get it.
That's exactly right. So all technicians out there, be forewarned, do not complain about the lack of service gas if you're not reclaiming everything and repairing everything that you possibly can. So it falls on the service industry to have service gas going forward. Otherwise, you're going to be transitioning to ultra low GWP equipment faster.
Faster than you anticipated.
Yes.
That's right. Ooh,
that was fun.
Science. I like science.
That's right. And science to back it up. So anyone that's looking for more information, we really want you to connect, learn a little bit more about what Keeley is doing. Here's a link. I've also got a QR that I established. I had a couple things I wanted to get us to make sure that you, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry about that, Keeley. Hold on just a second. Did this last week to me. There we go. And if you have any last minute questions, throw them in the chat. If we don't get to them, we'll catch them on another episode. I mean, we truly hope that that clarified the entire topic of GWP 20 versus GWP 100.
AR4, AR5, AR6, what all those numbers mean. Hopefully you have a good understanding of all of this now.
Absolutely. Keeley, yes. Any other resources that you'd like for people to connect to learn more about what you're doing in the industry?
Well, I always recommend we put a newsletter out every month, and mm-hmm. we try to capture everything that has changed since the past month. And if we had tried to do that about 5 years ago, there wouldn't have been any content because very little change from like the 1980s up until a couple of years ago. And now the rate of change is just absolutely it's hard to keep up with. So we try to digest it all for you. We try to put the most important things in there and provide you with leaps. So you can either spend hours and hours and hours reading all the news and doing all the research. I say to people, let us do the work for you. It's a good way to keep up with things. So, and it's educational. It's not, you know, for marketing purposes. It's just trying to keep people updated on the latest news.
All right. We encourage everyone to go check that out. Thank you, Bruce, for hanging out with us. If you want to spend some time getting to know some of the educators from the industry, we encourage you to come hang out with us at the National HVACR Education Conference. If you're going to be at AHR, take a look at us. We're going to have our booth there. We'll be running around doing some interviews. Hope we have the chance to bump into you at a show or conference coming up. And once again, we're grateful, Keeley and Jason, for you hanging out with us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
I agree. This is a lot of fun. I'm glad Howard's out there. I'm not going to tell him how much fun I have on there.
How much am I paying you to have fun?
It's really about encouraging all of you in the industry. We rely on all of you to help prepare the next generation of technicians and students and contractors, because they are going to struggle. There's going to be a lot of changes. Change is difficult, but we are here to support you. We encourage you to come back every week, and we'll have a new topic for you. Let us know if you have something that you want to learn more on. And we will see you all again next week on Did You Know? The ESCO HVAC Show.